The advances of modern medicine could be a mixed bag. Here's a prime example. Because of advances in medical science and the fact that most of us don't smoke anymore, we tend to live longer. But the downside is that our bodies can essentially outlive our minds. Dementia is a risk that roughly doubles every 5 years after we reach 65. Somewhere north of 5 million people have some form of dementia in our country. Our guest this hour suggests moving the focus from cure, slow and coming, to care, which we can provide right now. Tia Powell is an MD and the author of Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. She is professor of psychiatry and bioethics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx section of New York City, where she also directs the Center for Bioethics. Tia Powell, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
So you probably had done lots of work on dementia before it happened to family members. Would that be a fair assumption?
Not really, actually. I mean, partly because when my grandmother had dementia, I was still quite young, and I couldn't fairly be described as having done much work of any kind at all at that point in my early 20s. So I was just sort of getting started and figuring out what I wanted to do. So I became aware of dementia very early on as a young adult, and that was the first time I learned something about it, how hard it was. But then later, when my mother had dementia, I was an adult. I was a physician and a medical school professor. But even so, I was not then really a specialist in dementia. I'm a psychiatrist. I do a lot of work in bioethics. And I certainly had done a lot of work around end-of-life issues and trying to help people figure out what kind of death they want, what's helpful, what's not so helpful, and medical care decisions at the end of life. But I wasn't really an expert in any way in dementia before it really became something I had to think about for my mother. And I found that what I knew as a psychiatrist, as a medical school professor, as a physician, didn't really prepare me all that well. So then I really set out to figure out, well, what do I want to know? And what do I think other people might like to share? And that's what really got me started writing the book.
I did not expect the first vignette in the book about a chorus concert with the Unforgettables. What is that group about?
Oh, my goodness. They are so wonderful. This is a choral group that's in New York City, but actually there are quite a few around the country. I don't know if there is one where you are, but I wouldn't be surprised if there is. It's a group, a singing group for people with dementia and their partners. Could be a spouse, could be an adult daughter or son, or just a neighbor or friend. And they come together and they sing usually sort of classics, jazz standards, that kind of thing. And it is so moving and so joyful. And I have to say that going and sitting in and seeing people with dementia having a fabulous time, and actually so fabulous that sitting there in the audience, it's not really obvious who had dementia and who didn't, even though you knew that the chorus was kind of 50-50, roughly divided. And that really made me think, more of this. Why can't we have more of this? Dementia is hard. I don't deny it. It is sad. All kinds of things like that are true about it. But why can't it also be more true that you can have joy? And if we think about this more, couldn't we find more joy in lives with dementia? Because it's a lot of us now, it's going to be even more and more. And if we can't put some joy into those lives with dementia, there's going to be a lot of lives with no joy. And that's a shame. It shouldn't be that way.
Do you think we'd be thinking this much about dementia if our society wasn't aging so much demographically, if the average age of the United States wasn't so high?
Well, our average age is actually not particularly high relative to other democracies, but it's getting higher every year. So now it's about 15% of the U.S. that is 65 or older, and that number is only going to go up. And I think you're absolutely right. I think we didn't used to think about dementia this much because there were a lot fewer old people. And now that our society, you know, each of us individually, of course, is getting older, but as a group, we're also getting older. We do live a lot longer than we used to. So, you know, 100 years ago, people didn't even really think of dementia as an illness. They just thought, well, I don't know, you know, some old people get stupid, so what? I don't care. It wasn't really an object of study for physicians or much of anybody else, but you can't get away with that anymore. There are a lot of older people, an increasing number of older people, and a lot of them have dementia. So now it's really kind of right in our face. We got to think about this is here, it's now, and it's only going to be more of an issue for us. So let's have a better plan. What should we do about this? What should we do for people with dementia and for the people who care about them?
You do advocate moving from cure to care, but you do also give us an update on the search for cures. It doesn't sound like it's going really quickly.
So the search for cures is one that's ongoing. I hope one day it's successful. There are lots of really smart people working on this. People have been working on it really hard since maybe the 1970s. But to tell you the truth, they're nowhere today. I'm not nowhere. We know a lot about dementia. We just don't know how to fix it. We don't know how to slow it down or prevent it or cure it. And not only do we not know that today, it really doesn't look like we're going to know that in time for the baby boomers, which is a bummer, and I'll admit that. That's some, you know, bad news. We have to take it straight up. The reason for that is, let's just think about Alzheimer's disease. That's one of the most common forms of dementia. These amyloid plaques, these kind of sticky plaques that form in your brain, are the defining brain pathology for Alzheimer's disease. Those get going. Those are in real formation at least 10 years before you ever have symptoms. So things are changing in your brain before you ever know that you have dementia, before you have dementia. At the same time, it takes a really long time for a medication to go from a good idea to something that you can prescribe to people. And that's right. Medications can be dangerous. They cannot hold up to their initial promise. We've got to test them. We've got to go carefully here. We can maybe speed it up a little bit, but you can't rush stuff to market. Bad things happen when you do that.
All right, so cure is still a bit away. We need to take a break here. Tia Powell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of psychiatry in New York City. Her book is called Dementia Reimagined, and we'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about it in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia that afflict us later in life and how we should be thinking about those. Professor of Psychiatry and Bioethics Tia Powell wrote a book about it called Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Your email comments and questions are welcome at jx@jeffnet.org. Tia, you were just talking about amyloid plaques showing up about 10 years before we start showing any symptoms. Is there any way yet to detect them while we're still alive? Tia, you there? Did we lose Tia? All right, we're going to pick up the phone and dial it.
Now I'm back in. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry about that. So we can now detect amyloid plaques in people who are alive. And that's pretty new. That's kind of an experimental discovery from just the last few years. So you can take a picture with a special kind of PET scan using a certain kind of chemical dye that goes in it, and it shows you whether or not you have amyloid. So that's good. The problem is amyloid doesn't tell you if you have the symptoms of dementia. It certainly puts you at risk. But there are people who have dementia that looks just like Alzheimer's disease and don't have any symptoms of dementia. And then, astonishingly, there are people with tons of amyloid who live to a really long time and never get symptoms of dementia. So we can tell you if you have amyloid, we just can't tell you what it means. So that's kind of a, you know, one step forward, one step back kind of picture. It's just an experimental process right now. It really won't do you much good to go out and try and get that test. And you can't walk into a doctor's office and get it. I'm kind of okay with that because we don't really know how to interpret it today.
It sure sounds like there's a lot of room for mystery there still. So here's where you advocate moving away from thinking of cure to thinking of care. And as a doctor yourself, as an MD, how hard is it for medicine to think in those terms?
It's a lot harder than it should be. You know, medicine has, it's like a kind of slightly annoying relative who has a very big idea of himself or herself. And we like to think in medicine that we are all about cure. And cure is a beautiful thing, no question. To tell you the truth, though, a lot of what we do, most of what we do, is not really about cure. It's about managing illness. That's what we do with cancer. When we say we've cured cancer, for a lot of people, that basically means disease-free survival for 5 years. I say it like that. It doesn't sound quite so dramatic. It doesn't mean it's never coming back. It means you don't have it today, and that's great. But it's not exactly what the standard English word cure means. So we don't have a cure for dementia. We don't even actually have good treatments for it. We have medications that are kind of palliative in nature. They help some people with some symptoms for some period of time, but nobody argues that the medicines that we have are a cure. And in fact, if you meet somebody who tells you this will cure or prevent dementia, what they're selling you, I just have to say, is baloney. That is just not a true statement. The FDA just sent a dozen warning letters to people who sell supplements who make claims that they can prevent dementia because there is, in fact, no data to support that. So, unfortunately, the bad news is the true news here.
What about the exercise and diet? We have had a couple of people on who suggest that you can slow and maybe in some cases even reverse some of the symptoms of dementia with changing diets and increasing exercise.
I wouldn't say reverse symptoms of dementia. It's a very semantic argument. But certainly exercise is great for you. Exercise is good for your heart. It's good for your head. It sort of gets everything moving, gets oxygen where it needs to go. And every single study of big data, lots of people, supports that exercise is helpful in protecting your cognitive health. Diet, it's a little bit trickier picture. I personally believe that diet does make a difference, but it's really hard to study diet because, frankly, people cheat. Everybody remembers to write down the green beans. We're a lot less likely to write down the bag of chips that we grabbed on the way out the door. So it's really hard to get an honest account of something that people do all day, every day, and add that up at the end of 5 years over thousands of people and get really strong data. It's not going to be clean data, so it's very hard to show a benefit from diet. But I do think it makes a difference to eat basically, essentially what's called usually the Mediterranean diet. Lots of fruits and vegetables, not so much meat, maybe a little bit of dairy, fish is cool, lots of legumes and nuts and stuff like that. But that's really different than the standard American diet. So that's the Mediterranean diet does seem to be better for you.
Yeah, you're so right. I was remembering just the other day, well, I had a salad today and some vegetables. So, oh, wait, I forgot about that big chocolate glob this morning. Those kinds of things.
Exactly. It's human nature, you know, it's just fine.
True. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to let our audience know again that we're talking to Tia Powell about her book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Steve and Eugene got on the line very early, and he usually calls in when we talk about dementia. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Tia Powell.
Howdy. Again, with the first state of the nation to pass what's called the Death of Dignity Act.
Steve, rotate that phone so it gets right in front of your mouth, please.
Okay, Oregon was the first in the nation to pass what's called the Death with Dignity Act. Mm-hmm. Now, part of the structures on this are that you have to be within 6 months of death, and you have to be mentally competent. Now, people with dementia, by the time they're within 6 months of death, often drooling and in diapers. Meanwhile, earlier on in the disease, they're said to have, oh, he has good days and he has bad days. Well, on the good days, and there should be a way to determine this, it seems to me that they should be able to take care of this law. Two questions. What do you think of the whole idea of Death with Dignity, and what do you think about the catch-22 that Alzheimer's seems to fall into?
All right. Thanks for that, Steve. Appreciate it. Tia?
Steve, this is such an important issue, and I'm really glad you've raised it. I do talk about it at some length in the book. You are absolutely right. Not just Oregon, but all the states that have passed laws that facilitate physician aid in dying rule out using that for somebody with dementia. Just as you say, that model law is the same in all the states, and it says you have to have 6 months or less to live, and you have to have full decision-making capacity. that's really because to get these laws passed, nobody really wants to think about euthanasia and terminating the lives of people who can't decide for themselves, somebody maybe with Down syndrome or something. People get very upset about that, so that's why the law is the way it is. I don't personally think there's any possibility of that law changing because many states are trying to pass similar laws and they're all doing it just on the same template. So I don't think that that physician aid in dying is coming for people with dementia. Now, you say that people with dementia will die drooling in diapers. This is a really hard phrase. I have to tell you, I'm a doctor. Everybody who dies of a chronic illness dies incontinent and extremely frail. We all die drooling in diapers. I don't see that that shows a lack of dignity. It isn't whether or not, you know, we care about what it looks like when the body breaks down. It's whether or not we're in pain. I think a couple of different things about this. One, nobody dying of anything should be worried about being in pain. We have to do a lot better job of making sure there's access to palliative care. And we have to have palliative care that's specific for people with dementia, because somebody with pretty advanced dementia might be in pain and not be able to tell you. So there are more sophisticated ways of examining somebody, predicting where they're going to have pain. Most people with dementia are older. A lot have arthritis, other things. Well, we know where they have arthritis. We should be able to examine that joint and see, does that look like that's giving the person pain? We can treat that. So I think they're different issues. I don't think that being frail and showing the symptoms of any dying person means necessarily a loss of dignity. I think we have to think about what dignity means. We have to respect people's wishes. We have to keep them out of pain. I also think there are a lot of people who think about suicide and dementia and taking their, you know, taking it into their own hands, the DIY approach. That's always been around. Nobody can take that away. If somebody's really committed to ending their life, I'll admit as a psychiatrist, they're going to win. But as a psychiatrist, I always like to think, but can't we really approach this in the way the hospice movement, the palliative care people do? What could we do to make today better? And if there comes a day when we can't make a day good enough, I understand that choice. But I don't want the rest of us to get off the hook. We should be helping everybody who thinks their life isn't worth living and sort of being with them. They shouldn't be isolated. They shouldn't be alone. They shouldn't feel disrespected. And they should feel like we've got their back and we'll see what we can do to either make them happy or stay out of their way if they choose to go forward. Does that answer your question, Steve?
He's off the line now, but that's a more comprehensive answer than I think he's ever gotten on that question, which he's asked several times. Steve, thank you. Okay. And Tia Powell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of psychiatry and bioethics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx in New York City. She's also the author of Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. You're welcome to join this conversation on the Exchange as we talk about some hard truths about what happens to us when our brains go and our bodies are still here. 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. You relate the story of your mother, and by this point you were a professional and had been so for a long time. A couple of things in here. This phrase in particular stopped me cold. You write, "For my mother, home had become a prison." How?
Well, that really came as a surprise to me. I really had the notion that any kind of facility, assisted living, nursing home, all terrible. Nobody wants to go there. Everybody wants to stay home. Well, you know, shows you how much I knew. My mother didn't want to stay home. We had kept her in the apartment that she shared with my dad, who then passed away. And she was kind of resistant. She didn't really want somebody to be there taking care of her, but we didn't think she was safe on her own. And indeed, we were right about that. So when my dad got really sick with cancer, we had somebody move in. And we told my mom, well, that's to take care of Dad. And then she didn't disappear after my dad passed away. But my mother did not get along with this person. My mom was private. Long before she had dementia, she was incredibly hard-headed and very clear about what she wanted to do and what she didn't want to do. And it really made her unhappy to have somebody sort of sitting in her house. The aide wanted to watch TV. My mother had a very strong moral code, and it did not permit ever for 1 minute for watching daytime TV. So
under no circumstances.
Whatever reason. She never had a broken leg, but if she had, I'm not sure she would have made an exception. So she was an active person all her life, and it was really tough for her. So we tried to find activities, and I think there's probably more going on in our community now than there was then, but wasn't really quite enough. So she actually moved to assisted living, and for her, that was much happier. She really wanted to be around people. They had a lot of great programs. The assisted living place that my mom went to was a kind of collaboration with a Catholic school next door. It was a Catholic facility, and they had a parochial school next door. And my mom, a million years earlier, had herself been a little parochial school girl. And she loved looking out her windows, seeing the little kids troop by, and the kids would come by at holidays and sing to the people in the assisted living. And it just seemed for her just a lot more fun, a lot more full of life than being at home in her own apartment. So, I mean, I guess the lesson is people are different. You don't know what somebody wants unless you ask them. And what you want, what seems obvious to you, that may not be the choice. Even somebody who you know really well is not maybe their choice.
You went through quite a journey, it looks like, from not just from your mother's declining mental faculties, but also her physical condition as her heart developed some issues here. You describe the journey from decision to decision, and she said, for example, years in advance, no pacemaker, but then the cardiologist walks in one day. I was sharing this story with my wife last night. What did he tell you?
He said, oh, this is great. She needs a pacemaker. And, you know, I was floored, but I'll tell you, I'm one of six children, and anybody who's from a big family knows what that means. Six people, 12 opinions. So even though I was the official healthcare proxy, I could tell you right now, that doesn't in any way mean that everybody said, oh, fine, we'll take a step back, no problem, you make all the decisions. Not happening in my family. I don't know about yours, but I've never met a family that's big that handles this differently. So my family was divided. There were those among us who thought, listen, she was super clear about this. She didn't want that pacemaker. Her mother had a pacemaker, and she felt terrible about it. My mother and all her siblings felt terrible that they'd given their mother a pacemaker. We should not do it. But we did have some holdouts that said, well, listen, she's not suffering right now, really, and this is treatable. Shouldn't we try and get her a little more good time? So we went back and forth and back and forth, and then the day she was supposed to get the procedure, we thought, oh, we'll do it. We'll try to shut it down, but the cardiologists are terrible about this. They make it really hard to shut a pacemaker down, even though their own guidelines say you should be able to do that. So the guy comes in, you know, and says, I'm come to take you for a procedure to get a pacemaker. And she finally snapped out of it. You know, people with dementia, they have good days and bad days, as we heard. And she had a good day, and she looked him in the eye and went, no way. You know, you guys do too much stuff to old people. Get away from me. So she was herself in a really important way in that minute. She came back to her longstanding opinion and said, don't do it. And what it meant is that, really, it meant she had a better death. She had more than one fatal illness, which is not uncommon. You have dementia. Often you're an older person. Often you have a number of things breaking down at the same time. So in a sense, her heart disease was a blessing. It meant that it was quick, it was painless, and she had no fear of it. She didn't remember she had that problem. She didn't have any symptoms with it. And she used to have these little spells. She wouldn't remember them afterward. And it meant that she didn't end up in that last final phase of dementia. That is really hard to make comfortable for somebody. So she had an off-ramp that appeared. And the doctor, meaning to do good, thought he was helping her by blocking that off-ramp. And instead, we let her take it. I don't know if she'd had the pacemaker, if she would have had any more time, but she certainly would have been at much greater risk for suffering. And in any case, she would have died within a year. So what benefit there would have been by this medical procedure? Hard for me to say. We didn't really see it. And in the end, I'm really glad she didn't get that pacemaker.
So here's a lesson again to make sure that your wishes are completely clear and known and on paper and signed by you when you are still lucid.
Yes, sir. That is a really important lesson. And it's also tricky because, you know, most of us, we don't know what's going to break down. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what's going to happen. So make your wishes known. And also make sure that your family has a good sense of your values. So if it's really getting toward the end, if you've got dementia, and you will be lucid typically at the beginning of that diagnosis, tell them if this is what you think. When it gets toward the end, just, that's okay. I get it that that's where things are going. I want you to keep me comfortable. I don't want to spend a lot of time in the hospital. I don't want to have a lot of procedures. That's what most people think. They don't. Another 2 months in the ICU, restrained and sedated, is not what most people are hoping for. They are really hoping for comfort and to be around their family and to be comfortable. So I think if we did that for more people, dementia might seem a little bit less terrible to the rest of us.
Here again, the focus moving from getting hooked on the idea of a cure to care is what Tia Powell proposes in her book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Tia and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Tia Powell, professor of psychiatry and bioethics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City in the Bronx. She's written a book to move the focus, she hopes, from thinking about cures for dementia to care for dementia. Her book is called Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your thoughts, questions, comments by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's quite a lengthy history lesson in here, which proves, for one thing, that dementia is not new. What was it often called in the past, Tia?
Oh, it had all kinds of different names. There was, you know, senile dementia and all kinds of things. And dementia praecox was actually an ancient name for schizophrenia. That's what that's what they called it in the 19th century. So the word dementia meant all kinds of different things earlier in medical history. And more importantly, people didn't really focus on and think about dementia as a specific illness. They just thought some older people get confused. I don't know. I don't care. Nobody studied it. Nobody looked at it. So now we know a lot more about the specific ways in which the brain can break down and form dementia. There are quite a number of different types of dementia. There's Alzheimer's, of course, very common, but also frontotemporal dementia, which often strikes people at kind of a younger age. There's dementia with Lewy bodies, which Robin Williams had. And there are dementias that have to do with Parkinson's disease and AIDS and quite a number of other things.
So the number I cited was from at the beginning was from Alzheimer's Association, indicating somewhere between 5 and 6 million Americans with dementia. Does that include everything, or is that just Alzheimer's?
5 includes Alzheimer's. It's probably 6 or even more million once you include everybody in there. The other types are smaller. Although, I'll tell you frankly, though, I don't think we count which types very well.
Right.
A lot of people are told they have Alzheimer's disease, but in fact, the one test that can really demonstrate that is really only used in the research setting. And for the most part, we just say it's Alzheimer's because that's the name that people recognize, but that may or may not be true. We're probably wrong about a quarter to a third of the time when we say it's Alzheimer's disease. So it could be vascular, could be, you know, dementia caused by lots of little mini strokes that might not even show up on a CT scan or something. And all these other different kinds, even new kinds that are ones we didn't know about before, and a combination. Your brain doesn't actually have to pick just one. It can have, you know, dementia as a cumulative effect of a bunch of different things going on for you.
So here in the past, when we were, you know, dealt with people as if they were insane, a lot of institutionalization, apparently. We have talked a lot on this program about mental institutions and deinstitutionalization. Were a lot of the residents of the state hospitals back in the warehousing days older people with dementia?
Yeah, they sure were. It's really sad. You know, once upon a time, the mental institution was the kinder, gentler approach. And there were these wonderful, idealistic reformers in the early 19th century. And they were right, and they did good things, because actually before that, we threw people with mental illness in jail and chained them and just yelled at them and tried to tell them, stop being the way you are. So that wasn't so great. So they built mental institutions to try and give real treatment. But over time, they really became decrepit. It was clear that just being kind to people, although that's important, wasn't enough to cure people. So we stopped funding mental institutions adequately. And as time went by, they became a warehouse for keeping people who couldn't take care of themselves. Well, Venice now, that was a lot of older people, particularly older people with dementia. So by the time we get into deinstitutionalization, some of those people did have serious mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar illness or major depression. But by the time they've been there for 30 years, many were old enough that they also had dementia. And some had gone in at an older age and started with dementia. That was the only illness that they'd had that was relevant. So there was just no way that those people could make it out of an institution. They didn't necessarily need the institution they were in, which were those were pretty beat and kind of scary places at the time. But the notion that we'll just open the doors and you'll walk free and everything will be great, boy, was that a bad idea. People really needed help. There were a lot of frail elders that were in those institutions who it was long past time when they were able to really get up on their own two feet and take care of themselves. In fact, some of them were never getting up on their two feet. They were bedbound. They were wheelchair bound. They were old and frail, and they needed us to take care of them. And in some cases, we really failed pretty miserably.
Now, while we were doing that in state hospitals, we did have a lot of research going on to figure dementia out. You walk us toward Alois Alzheimer, for whom the disease is named, but you pause for a while, in fact, at Solomon Carter Fuller. Who was he and what did he contribute?
He is a fascinating character. I have to tell you, I just loved finding out about him. I really fell down the rabbit hole reading about him and researching. So he is a really interesting guy. He is a true, he's an African-American in the sense he was born in Africa, in Liberia, where his parents and grandparents had gone to escape slavery. He was born there as a free man. He came to the U.S. In the early 1900s. Incredibly smart guy, shows up as a new immigrant, gets himself into one of the historic black colleges, which were, you know, pretty new institutions then, gets himself a college education. That's not enough for him. He wants to go to medical school. He goes to Boston University Med School. That's not enough for him. He works. He's still studying. He's really trying to figure out what's the connection between what's really happening in the brain and symptoms of different kinds of mental symptoms and deterioration. And he ends up applying for and getting an incredibly prestigious opportunity to study in Europe in the laboratories of Alois Alzheimer, which was something that the elite of American physicians did in those early years of the 1900s. There was no stopping this guy. So then he comes back and he knows literally more than anyone else in the United States about what Alzheimer's is doing. Alzheimer was his mentor. And Alzheimer's publishes a paper saying this kind of younger woman has this thing going on in her brain. And I think it's because of these plaques and tangles. I think that's why she has dementia. And Solomon Carter Fuller starts writing some papers, incredible, beautiful science, publishes them saying, that's super interesting. Tell you the truth, I don't really think that those plaques are necessary nor sufficient for dementia. So he says this in like 1910 or 11. That's where we are today. People have been arguing about that hard for like the last 50 years. And a month ago, one more big clinical trial just failed for people who are trying to really say plaques are Alzheimer's disease. Well, it hasn't worked to decrease those plaques. We can make the plaques get fewer. It doesn't help you with your dementia. So we're kind of, not everybody, but a substantial number of neuroscience researchers are back today. Well, where Solomon Carter Fuller was in 1910. I wish we'd listened more to that guy. He was really something. So it was just such a, it really made me fall out of my chair. I was just blown away by this guy. So smart, so interesting, so ahead of his time.
Well, truly, and then when you remark in the book and show us the timeline that it took more than 60 years after Alzheimer himself died to finally have an association named after him to begin giving this disease a name. I mean, and you point out, too, that there's a role that Dear Abby herself played in this.
She sure did. Yeah, that was pretty wild. So, you know, Alzheimer's disease was named after him shortly after he published about it in the early years of the 20th century, but it just disappeared. It only at that time was used to apply to the tiny number of people who had early onset dementia, so younger than 65. And back then it was a very small number. We didn't really recognize it much. So it kind of went into the woodwork. You know, nobody thought about this. But then in the 70s or 80s, there were more and more older people, more and more people getting dementia. And one of them, before this was well known at all, writes a letter to Dear Abby and says, Abby, you got to help me. My husband, he's really fallen apart here. He can't work anymore. He can't drive. I can't leave him at the house with him. And they tell me it's something called Alzheimer's disease. I've never heard of it. Have you? And Abby writes back a letter and says, you know, yes, I checked this out. There is such a thing. You got to write to get a pamphlet. And she gives the address for this first little teeny, teeny, teeny branch of the Alzheimer's Association. And it almost crushes them. They get, I forget the numbers, it's something like 50,000 requests for their little pamphlet, like the next week, because Dear Abby shone a spotlight on this illness. And that was really part of the beginning of the much greater sense of awareness that we have today, that dementia is a real thing. We got to focus on it. We got to figure out this what this is, and we got to figure out what to do about it.
We have a letter here, an email from Carol in Trinidad, California. She writes that Matthew Walker of UC Berkeley's Sleep Lab, in his book Why We Sleep, writes, sleep addresses a new candidate for hope on all three fronts, diagnosis, prevention, and therapeutics. He describes how sleep disruption and Alzheimer's disease are causally linked. It is in deep NREM sleep that the glial cells shrink in size, allowing the cerebrospinal fluid to flush out metabolic waste, including beta amyloid and tau proteins associated with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So wishing you both good sleeping for a full 8 hours, says Carol in Trinidad. How good is the connection from your research into between sleep and dementia?
So there's a lot of fabulous research going on around dementia, and there are super smart people working on it, and I bet they will start to get somewhere. I just don't think it's going to be in time for the baby boomers. But that said, I think the sleep research is fabulous. There are people really looking, you know, if you think about it, we just take sleep for granted, but we never really known, yeah, but why the heck do we need that? What's it actually doing? Why do we need that sort of screensaver time there? It's a third of our life. What actually does sleep do? So people are beginning to understand that. And one of the things that it does is it kind of lets your brain take out the trash. There are these wild little proteins in there. There's one called ubiquitin that goes around and it's kind of tagging things going, oh, no, I don't need that anymore. It tags stuff with destruction. And there's part of a cleanup function. It's sort of a maintenance crew is going around your brain while you're sleeping going, oh, no, we don't need that anymore. Let's get rid of this guy. And you need that. Without that, you know, your brain will look just like your kitchen looks if you don't take out the trash for a week. So it's a fascinating, really creative, really interesting way of looking at how we break down and how we might be able to help people maintain cognitive function for longer. So, yeah, you could think about general hygiene. We already knew that making sure you get enough sleep is good for you. And maybe we can do a little bit more with that as time goes by. Maybe we can help this cleanup crew do their job a little bit better. So it's a very hopeful line of research that a number of people are working on.
So clearly we need to think about self-care as we get older and to do the things we've been talking about, exercise, diet, you know, the things that just keep you generally healthy. And I wonder, though, when we're talking about the care for people who are getting deeper into dementia, are there clear deflection points where the kind of care changes when the activities of the individual with dementia need to change?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are some things that are really tough about dementia. It may make it hard for you to stay at home, for instance. It may really mean that you need something different. At the beginning, you know, dementia is a very incremental process. So you start out fine. And then bit by bit, you will lose some functions. But it's very uneven. It's very individualized. It goes faster in some people, slower in others. And then the same person can go fast for a little while and then slow down. So at the same time, you retain a lot of aspects of yourself. You feel like yourself. You certainly know when people are kind to you, and you might know when they're unkind also. And you have your sense of what you prefer and what you don't prefer. So in the beginning, you may just need a little bit of help the way we all do. Maybe when you need to go to the doctor, it might be really helpful if you have a relative or a friend or maybe even some kind of companion who can go with you, because we all have that experience. You go to the doctor, you're kind of anxious. they tell you, well, this is what I think it is, this is what you should do. It would be great just in the beginning maybe to offer, see if they'd be willing to have you go along and just have another memory there, another person to sort of help remember, hey, you wanted to ask about this. Or remember last week when you felt faint, you weren't sure what to do? Let's ask about that. So that kind of thing could be great at the beginning. Later, of course, dementia is really severe. A person could have trouble with a lot of basic functions. One of the most embarrassing ones is incontinence, right? So in late phases of dementia, that absolutely happens. And that's terribly embarrassing for lots of people. But you know what? That is an engineering problem. We could do a lot better. We could do, and there are a lot of people, frankly, who are incontinent, who are not demented, and not even old. There are accident victims. There are veterans of our wars who need a lot of help with this. They're young, vigorous people, but they are incontinent. And partly because of that group, we're thinking a little bit differently about this. So how could you have an active life, feel safe, feel secure, and not feel like you're wearing a baby diaper? So we've got to get more smart people working on that kind of thing.
All right. Again, the book moves the focus from cure to care, because cure doesn't seem like it's going to make it in time for the baby boomers in Tia Powell's experience. She is the professor of psychiatry and bioethics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. The book is Dementia Reimagined. Tia, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Take care.